here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, February 8th. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:11 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent news. Today, our headlines will cover local news from around Vancouver, provincial and national news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world brought to you by Democracy Now! And Free Speech Radio News.
All this, plus your weekend weather forecast brought to you by Phil from the UBC Storm Club, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus and local headlines.
As the Arts Undergraduate Society elections near, concrete plans for fee increases have been disclosed. If arts students vote in favor of the building plans, there will be minor fee increases, $15 per student per year for the first 5 years, and then increase to $25 per student after that. This would be on top of the current Arts Undergraduate Society fee, which is $13. Based on the expectation that students will pitch in about $2.7 million, the fee would be around for more than 11 years. The timeline for the project hasn't been set in stone yet, but the AUS president, Harsev Oshan, said he hopes the building will be ready within 5 years, so students paying the higher $25 fee will get to use the space. This new building would replace the existing art student space in Buchanan D, known as the Meekinson Art Student Space. The AUS hasn't yet confirmed an architect or a firm budget for the project, but they're expecting to raise roughly half of the project's budget through student fees and the rest through alumni donations. Oshan said campus and community planning has given the AUS two options for the location of the potential student center, one beside Brock Hall, where a temporary building for the former Department of Women's and Gender Studies once stood, and another between Buchanan Tower and Buchanan E Block. In either space, Oshan said, the center would be limited to under 10,000 square feet by UBC campus and community planning's edicts on faculty student spaces. Oshan said he hopes to provide club space for all of the 18 departmental clubs in the new building, as well as a UBC Food Services Cafe. The project only has preliminary approval from UBC as of yet, but Oshan hopes students will vote in favor of the fee. Quote, should the referendum pass, that would add a lot of weight behind our negotiations, saying students actually want this and are willing to pay for it. End quote. Voting in the student space fee referendum will take place from February 11th to the 15th.
UBC will be initiating a new financial assistance program over the next 2 years under the new program. All domestic students who need financial help will make their financial situation known to UBC when they first apply to the university. UBC will use the information to create a financial profile, quote-unquote, to determine how much money to give the student. The money may come in the form of bursaries, scholarships, or possibly even work-study jobs. Students who already receive financial assistance from UBC will have to reapply under the new system, which will likely come into effect by 2015. Creating the software and infrastructure for the program will cost approximately $4 million. Barbara Crocker, lead director of the program, said, quote, the goal of the project is to ensure that the students who need the funding to come to UBC will have that funding, end quote. According to Crocker, UBC gives away approximately $10 million in bursaries annually. Of the 4,500 students who apply, 3,400 to around 4,000 students, which is about 75 to 89%, receive bursaries ranging from $100 to $15,000. Bursaries are currently given to students who have an unmet need above the student loan maximum. This new system will allow for more students to apply for financial aid. However, there is not a projected increase in funds to hand out. Crocker said, quote, "We have to balance the total need with the total amount we have to spend. That's where this is. We need to manage and control the spending here," end quote. Scholarship applications will be integrated into the financial profile, but they will be awarded based on merit. The university has a policy that says no qualified domestic students should be turned away from attending UBC due to costs. But Barbara Crocker said the limited amount of bursary money available will continue to prevent UBC from giving students everything they ask for. The financial profile would take into account parental income, and it will expect parents to pitch in for their adult children's education. This is a highly contested issue, as some parents do not contribute to their children's educational costs. Crocker said there would be an appeal process set up in the event of such cases. Between now and the month of May, Crocker and her team will be figuring out the technical details for this new program. She hopes the project will be implemented by March 2015. Crocker said, quote, "We want to continue to work with students and have input as we move forward so that there are no surprises at the end of the day."
On Monday, Outweek officially kicked off with a rainbow flag raising ceremony in the courtyard between the Sub and Brock Hall, with similar flags being installed along Westbrook Mall during the previous week. Our City of Colors, a nonprofit group started in 2011, now has over 100 members and aims to promote the visibility of LGBTQ people, that's lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual, and queer, who may face intolerance from their ethnic communities. The organization held an anti-discrimination workshop on campus this past Monday as part of UBC's Outweek programming, a series of events celebrating LGBTQ people. The organization's most prominent campaign is a series of multilingual posters depicting LGBTQ people from a variety of ethnic backgrounds. They show real Vancouverites and list cultural and family activities they enjoy alongside matter-of-fact descriptions of their LGBTQ identities. These posters are in many languages, including Chinese, English, Farsi, Filipino, and Russian. Posters have been put up throughout the Lower Mainland. At UBC, the posters can be seen at Brock Hall and in the Sexual Assault Support Center, among other places. UBC Outweek co-organizer Tamara Brown said, "Our City of Colors is doing important work to help promote diversity and acceptance." Brown said, quote, "We do have queer people from a variety of different cultures, and our City of Colors really recognizes that and tries to promote the idea that you can be queer and be from any culture, and still be out and happy and celebrated," end quote.
A University of British Columbia study of North American attitudes, specifically United States, towards climate change, finds that local weather, temperature in particular, is a major influence on public and media opinions on the reality of global warming. The study, published today by the journal Climatic Change, finds a strong connection between U.S. weather trends and public and media attitudes towards climate science over the past 20 years, with skepticism about global warming increasing during cold snaps and concern about climate change growing during hot spells. UBC geography professor Simon Donner, who conducted the study, says that, quote, "Our findings help to explain some of the significant fluctuations and inconsistencies in U.S. public opinion on climate change," end quote. The researchers used data between 1990 and 2010 from U.S. public opinion polls and media coverage by major U.S. newspapers, including the New York Times, Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and USA Today. They evaluated the relationship between average national temperature and opinion polls on climate change, along with the quantity and nature of media editorials and opinion pieces related to climate change.
Anti-poverty activists rallied outside the Vancouver Aquarium Thursday morning, demanding Premier Christy Clark raise welfare rates. The group said they chose the aquarium because the premier said families should go to the facility on the newly created Family Day holiday. But they said with today's welfare rate in BC, many families are living in poverty and will not be able to afford a trip to the aquarium. Earlier in the week, six of BC's largest charities used the upcoming Family Day holiday to emphasize that the government needs to help out young families who are struggling. The YMCA, YWCA, United Way, Family Services, Boys and Girls Clubs, and the Vancouver Foundation put out a news release to highlight the financial hardship young families face. That came after UBC professor Paul Kershaw's report that young families in the province are facing increased financial woes due to the high cost of living. Anti-poverty activist Jean Swanson noted a single parent with one child gets $1,236 a month to live on from welfare and the child benefit tax, or benefit. But she said if they do the math, that single parent would need about $1,961 to live on in a month. The group wants to see the basic welfare rate bumped up to $1,300 a month for a single person.
Despite overwhelming public opposition, the Vancouver Park Board passed a plan to pool and control revenue from community centres. Hundreds protested the plan at a marathon public meeting that began on Monday evening, but the Vision Vancouver Majority Board endorsed it after 3 a.m. on Tuesday. However, the Park Board General Manager Malcolm Bromley told the crowd that the plan for a new partnership agreement between the board and the community center associations that operate the facilities is not set in stone. It calls for 5 months of further negotiations with the associations, a process that started more than a decade ago. All details, including the controversial shakeup in who controls revenue, are on the negotiation table. Bromley said this in front of a doubting and sometimes sneering crowd. Bromley also added that $13 million in surplus that associations currently have will not be touched and associations will be able to apply for grants.
As it stands, the Park Board provides 46% of the funds for the 23 centers through taxes. Facility-generated revenue, controlled by the community center associations that often save their pennies for future projects, provides 49%. The plan's goal is to balance the services provided at community centers in wealthier and poorer neighborhoods. The Park Board wants universal access across community centers for residents regardless of their ability to pay full price. The Park Board wants to administer any surplus revenue going forward to level the playing field and make the finances more efficient, but it's going to be tough to negotiate with the association volunteers who express concerns about service cuts and top-down decision-making.
In local news, hundreds of Simon Fraser University's lowest paid employees aren't able to afford the basic necessities for their families, according to a new report from the Living Wage Campaign for Families. In a press release issued today, the campaign says the report, which won't be released until February 20th, found 73% of custodians, research assistants, and childcare and food service workers made less than $19.14 an hour, the living wage calculated for the Lower Mainland. This wage rate, which was calculated by the Living Wage Campaign for Families, covers the cost of food, clothing, transportation, housing, education, childcare, health costs, and incidentals for a two-parent, two-child family. It does not cover the cost of paying down a student loan or credit card debt, saving for your retirement, extra health costs, such as caring for a disabled family member, or family vacations. The report relies on reviewing collective agreements for contracted workers, as well as survey of close to 40 contracted workers. The campaign director, Michael McCarthy Flynn, said the number surveyed was so low because workers were afraid to speak out. Today's media release and the upcoming official report release are part of the campaign strategy to make Simon Fraser University the first living wage employer university in the country. At least 22 universities in the United States, including MIT, University of California at Berkeley, and the 8 so-called Ivy League universities, have adopted living wage policies, as have 13 others in the United Kingdom.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your provincial and national headlines and weather.
There's a whale, there's a whale, there's the whale fishes blow, and the whale was in full view. Whale fish, whale fish, whale fish.
Are you a senior undergrad or graduate student wanting to supercharge your professional development and meet the right people in the ocean sciences? Then register now for Power Up, networking and training on February 27th, sponsored by Ocean Networks Canada. For more information, go to regonline.ca/poweruponc.
What sort of fish are you?
Oscar Peterson was born in Montreal of Caribbean parents in 1925. In his lifetime, he became regarded by many as the greatest jazz pianist in the world. Among Peterson's innumerable awards and honors were Grammys, the International Jazz Hall of Fame Award, Junos, the Order of Canada, the Order of Arts and Letters in France, the Governor General's Performing Arts Award, and many honorary degrees. Although best known as a pianist rather than a composer, in 1964 Peterson released the Canadiana Suite, an album of 8 original compositions in tribute to Canada. Next is a clip off the album entitled Hogtown Blues, Peterson's ode to the city of Toronto. This PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM.
And welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend brought to you by Phil from the UBC Storm Club. Hi, Phil.
Hi, CJ. Thanks, as always, for the nice intro. Good evening, listeners. Some sunny weekend coming up with occasional cloud cover, says the models. High pressure aloft keeping a very large low system at bay over the Pacific. So that's going to give us generally dry weather and calm conditions with respect to winds. That ridge looks like it's going to weaken around Monday, though, so in about 72 hours. So in the long-term forecast, we're expecting some precipitation heading into next week. Looking at the airport sounding right now, temperature dew point lines reasonably far apart for today and tomorrow, we're not expecting any precipitation. Now the weather bulletin from Environment Canada. Tonight, mainly cloudy, low of +1. Saturday, a mix of sun and cloud, high of 6. Saturday night, partly cloudy, low of 0. And Sunday, a mix of sun and cloud, high of +5. Thanks for listening. That was the weather updates for this weekend, brought to you by UBC Storm Club as well as Environment Canada. I'm Phil Chang from Storm Club, reporting for News 101.
Thank you, Phil. That sounds great. No rain. It looks exciting. It's a party weekend. All right. Well, thank you, Phil. You are listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. It is now time for your provincial and national headlines.
BC is loosening liquor rules by allowing brewers and distillers to have on-site lounges and tasting rooms. Minister Rich Coleman says small and medium-sized liquor manufacturers can also own licensed establishments that are separate from their brewery, winery, or distillery. The government is also simplifying the rules for how liquor manufacturers can promote their products in bars and restaurants. In addition, liquor products made of 100% BC agricultural ingredients can be sold directly to the public without a liquor branch markup in price. The changes are the latest in a series of recent updates to BC liquor laws that have also included allowing booze to allowing liquor to be sold between shows and some movie theaters. Between shows at some movie theaters, letting people bring their own wine to restaurants, and allowing people to import wine from other provinces without paying BC taxes.
All right. Flights were grounded and schools were temporarily closed due to a large snowstorm blowing across Ontario. Environment Canada says affected regions can expect 15 to 25 millimeters of snow cover by the time when this extreme weather condition, which has already claimed the lives of 3 people, ends. On top of the deaths, Toronto police have cited the storm as a contributor to over 350 traffic accidents so far since midnight yesterday, including one which involved a bus transporting 38 passengers going off the road along Highway 401. The storm also affected the operations of schools, universities, and public transit. Classes were cancelled at several universities and colleges, including York and Ryerson Universities in Toronto, McMaster University in Hamilton, Brock University in St. Catharines, and the University of Guelph. In Toronto and the regions of York, Durham, and Simcoe, all public and Catholic schools remained open, but buses were cancelled. Schools were closed in Peel, Halton, and Hamilton-Wentworth regions. In the Ottawa area, schools were open, but buses were cancelled.
Prime Minister Stephen Harper says the closure of a Vancouver Coast Guard station is in keeping with his government's emphasis on public safety. The shuttering of the Kitsilano base announced last year has prompted demands from Premier Christy Clark and Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson for the government to change its mind, saying the move puts lives at risk. But Harper said on Friday that his government is allocating its resources in a way that is best for the public and that enhanced public safety. Many critics say that the Prime Minister's statement is ironic, considering that the Kitsilano base is in the heart of Vancouver's waterfront and is considered the busiest base in Canada, responding to more than 350 calls per year. Its closure was announced last spring, along with the closure of 3 other BC Coast Guard communication centres as part of the government's deep budget cuts. When it closes, calls will be handled primarily by the Coast Guard base at Sea Island in Richmond. That station will be getting a new hovercraft to allow faster response to localized calls. Jody Thompson, Deputy Commissioner of Operations for the Coast Guard, has acknowledged the closure will have an effect, but she has said reaction times will remain within international standards. And those are your provincial and national headlines for today. We're going to take a quick break, but we will be back with international news from FSRN and Democracy Now!
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the commercial drive area at
Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. It is now time for our international news, brought to you by Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Gunmen suspected to be members of an Islamist sect have shot and killed at least 9 people, mostly women, who were administering polio vaccine to children in Nigeria. The 2 attacks in the northern city of Kano appear to be part of a larger Islamist effort to stop vaccinations, which they say are intended to harm Muslims. FSRN's Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
The shooting incidents occurred at 2 health facilities where workers were preparing to administer the polio vaccine. In both incidents, gunmen riding on motorbikes opened fire and fled. Although no group has claimed responsibility, the Islamist group Boko Haram is believed to be behind the attack. Kano and other parts of Nigeria's predominantly Muslim north have a long history of opposition to polio vaccines. Some Muslim leaders claim it is part of a Western agenda to reduce the Muslim population by causing infertility. The distrust of vaccines was reinforced in 1996 after a drug trial by American pharmaceutical company Pfizer allegedly caused the deaths of several children in the city, triggering a protracted legal battle and eventual settlement. The killing of the health workers is a major setback in the global battle to eliminate polio. Nigeria is one of 3 countries where the disease still regularly occurs. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
A Palestinian man who launched a 100-day hunger strike last summer has been freed from Israeli prison, FSRN's Rami Almagari reports.
Akram Rihawi was one of two Gaza prisoners released by Israel on Thursday. He had been in prison since 2004, serving a 9-year term. After going on hunger strike for more than 100 days last spring to protest lack of medical care for political prisoners, Israel agreed to release him on January 25. But Israel did not follow through, and Rihawi went on hunger strike again. Mahmoud Sarsak is a former prisoner and hunger striker who lives in the same southern Gaza city as Rihawi and his large family. Sarsak was released last July after ending a 90-day hunger strike.
The release of Akram is one more victory for the Palestinian people in general and the prisoners in particular. It has also definitely proved that an individual hunger strike is a very effective way to push your cause with the prison warden.
Many Palestinian prisoners have used the hunger strike to push for better conditions and early release. Rihawi's strike last year was one of the longest in recent history. Rami Almagari, FSRN, Gaza.
Following up on a story from earlier this week, a controversial Seattle Police Department proposal to use camera-mounted drones has been halted by the mayor. Police wanted to use the small, remote-controlled aerial vehicles for hazmat and disaster response, search and rescue, crime scene and examination, and perhaps other uses with court approval. Critics are concerned about privacy, and activists fear the aircraft would be used to collect information on protesters during demonstrations. In a statement Thursday, Mayor Mike McGinn said it was time to end the discussion so the department could focus its resources on public safety and community building work. The city is currently working under a consent decree with the U.S. Justice Department after several high-profile cases involving police use of force and racial issues. An economic justice group in Eureka, California, says they have turned in nearly 2,700 signatures to put a 50% raise in the minimum wage before city voters. The Fair Wage folks want to increase the minimum wage from $8 to $12 per hour for large employers in the city. If the signatures are certified, the city council can choose to pass the Eureka Fair Wage Act or set a citywide election. Police alerts are in effect in three states in Mexico for a former Los Angeles police officer. Christopher Dorner released a manifesto this week complaining about racism and protectionism in the LAPD. Investigators say so far Dorner has shot and killed three people. FSRN's Lena Nozizwe reports that the search is now concentrating in Big Bear, east of Los Angeles, where police found his burned-out pickup truck.
Christopher Dorner is wanted for the Thursday murder of a police officer. He's also believed to have killed the daughter of former LAPD captain-turned-attorney Randall Kwan and her fiancé. Kwan represented Dorner after he was fired by LAPD. The department accused him of lying when he reported that another officer used excessive force on a mentally ill man. Dorner, who also served in the Navy, wrote about clearing his name and getting revenge in a manifesto police say he posted online. During the manhunt, two women delivering newspapers were injured by LAPD gunfire in what the police chief described as a case of mistaken identity. A photo from the site shows more than a dozen bullet holes in the tailgate and back windows of their truck, which, according to the women's attorney, was a different color and model than Dorner's. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
The EPA released a plan today on how to respond to climate change, saying that rising sea levels and changes in temperatures and rainfall threaten the country's air, water, and human health. The draft is now open for public comment. It identifies groups that are especially vulnerable to climate change, including the elderly, the poor, and indigenous communities. But as Secretary of State John Kerry meets today with Canadian officials to discuss issues, including the Keystone XL pipeline, some indigenous leaders say the U.S. government needs to better regulate the oil, natural gas, and coal companies that threaten their land. In Washington, D.C., FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
due to climate change, the EPA predicts more ozone pollution, more wildfires and droughts, more pest infestations and disease, and more public health crises for children, the elderly, and communities in poverty in the U.S. As for the nation's water, the agency warns of too much rain in some areas, not enough in others, and degraded water quality across the board. They note that indigenous communities are and will continue to be the hardest hit, because many gather plants and hunt for subsistence, have inadequate access to health care, and live near major sources of pollution.
Our sacred sites, our ceremonies, our plants, all of these things that are being destroyed in the name of capitalism, really.
That's environmental organizer Candy Mossett, who grew up on the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation in North Dakota. While the EPA report described the more technical aspects of climate change, including an increase in particulate matter and mercury contamination, Mossett told FSRN how the destabilized environment has already affected her community.
We're seeing changes in our water quality, and we're seeing changes in our yields of crops. And now what we're seeing, particularly in North Dakota, is a really big increase in asthmas, cancers, heart attacks, because of the increased levels of pollution, particularly with, I would say, from the flaring that's happening from hydraulic fracturing, because this is on top of the coal-fired power plants that are already there, many of them being grandfathered in because of how old they are. I have a lot of friends that have been sick and are sick now that are undergoing chemotherapy. My little niece was in the hospital for a month because her asthma was so bad that they couldn't believe she could still breathe.
Mossett is a member of the Indigenous Environmental Network, which has been organizing for years against many oil and tar sands pipelines, including TransCanada's Keystone XL. She said her community needs more assistance from the EPA and other government agencies in standing up to the oil and natural gas companies that have already set up extraction operations on their land.
The oil companies that are currently there are basically able to regulate themselves. There's so much illegal dumping, toxic waste being found in the water. We need air quality studies. We need water quality studies. You know, if they don't have the manpower to have people come do that, there are certainly people within our reservations that want to be able to monitor these things, but we don't necessarily have the equipment, nor do we have the money to get the equipment that's necessary.
The EPA report did promise to better allocate grants and resources, and specifically to empower indigenous tribes and other, quote, vulnerable groups to effectively adapt to climate change. Scientist Joe Casola with the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions says the agency now has to start studying how best to do this for each community.
In, let's say, a place that's affected by sea level rise, there's the potential to harden, to try to put in infrastructure to minimize damage. There's options to relocate, to have people move out of harm's way. There's ways to try to manage floodwaters a little better. Depending on the location, depending on the type of climate impact, that's a separate analysis you have to go through as far as what kind of makes the most sense.
In its report, the EPA raises an additional concern that they could become so swamped in responding to an increasing number of natural disasters that they won't have enough time or resources to enforce environmental laws. That's where Congress could come in, and one senator, Vermont Independent Bernie Sanders, says he'll attempt to push lawmakers to make climate change a priority.
The next step forward is we've got to be bold. We've got to address this, and we have to address it through a tax on carbon. We need to transform our energy system. We're going to be introducing legislation to do just that. But the issue is not political. This is an issue of physics. It's an issue of physics.
The EPA has posted the Climate Change Adaptation Plan on its website and will accept public comments for the next 60 days. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
The Study and Go Abroad Fair is proud to support CITR's fund drive from February 26th to March 8th. The fair is a great opportunity for anyone considering studying, volunteering, working, or traveling abroad. Exhibitors will include universities from around the world and student travel organizations. The Study and Go Abroad Fair happens Tuesday, March 5th from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. in the East Ballroom of the Vancouver Convention Center. All visitors will also be entered in a grand draw with prizes including a trip on Air Canada, a volunteer trip in Nicaragua or Nepal, and an iPad. CITR will also be doing a live broadcast from the fair with interviews, demos, and more. For more information, go to studyandgoabroad.com.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR. We will now continue with our international segments with Free Speech Radio News.
Police fired tear gas on crowds near a cemetery in Tunisia where tens of thousands of mourners attended the funeral for opposition leader Shoukry Belaid, who was shot and killed earlier this week. Video posted online by AFP shows dense crowds lining the street as Belaid's coffin, draped in the bold red color of the nation's flag, moved slowly through. Belaid's killing has sparked protests throughout Tunisia, and the ruling Ennahda party is divided on how to respond. This week marked some of the largest protests since the ouster of longtime leader Zine Abidine Ben Ali 2 years ago, which fueled similar upheavals across North Africa and the Arab world. For more, we're joined by Bernard Yaros, editor with the news site Tunisia Live. He's been following events today and joins us from Tunis. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much, Dorian.
There are reports of clashes at the funeral for Shoukry Belaid today. What happened?
Well, as always, Tunisia has been facing a lot of protests and strikes and general unrest in the past 2 years since the revolution. And in almost all of these cases, you always find about a handful or just 5% of the crowd or the people that are involved in these protests who are really just rabble rousers. We saw today a lot of footage of people going into cars, breaking into cars, setting them on fire, and throwing stones and rocks at the police, which then elicited their response of tear gas and obviously subsequent disorder. But by and large, everyone that marched from the birthplace of Shoukry Belaid, who is the slain political opposition leader. For everyone that participated in the funeral procession from his birthplace to the funeral, the vast majority was there to mourn his death and also to express their anger, as what they see is a failure on the part of the government to ensure the security of opposition figures, the security of journalists, and also the general security of the country.
In addition to the funeral and the protests that you're describing today, the Trade Union Federation also called for a strike. What was the scene like in Tunis?
Well, Tunisians woke up this morning to empty streets. All businesses, all local businesses were shut down. Even the major chain supermarkets such as Monoprix and Carrefour were all closed. Yesterday, there were scenes of huge crowds at these large supermarkets because people were trying to stock up on goods. So in general, everything was closed. The mood also, it was a rainy day, so the poor weather matched the mood in general.
And when are businesses expected to open back up?
Businesses are expected to open up tomorrow.
On Thursday, the Ennahda party rejected the prime minister's call to form what he called a government of non-political technocrats. Was this a new proposal or something that was considered before?
This is okay. So for the past several weeks, there has been talk in the air about a cabinet reshuffle, which basically means that they were going to switch in and out some ministers and include some politicians from other parties that are not part of the ruling troika coalition, which is made up of Ennahda and two secular parties, CPR and Etakatal. However, Jebeli's call yesterday for a non-political technocratic government is definitely a step above, or is definitely a much more radical proposition. By calling for a technocratic government, he's addressing the failures and the shortcomings and the poor performance of this government so far on two major fronts. First of all, to enforce security, and second of all, to implement a strong economic recovery, especially 2 years after the revolution, a revolution that was really based off the economic frustrations and desperation of the people.
But that proposal was rejected. So what could come next for the government and for next steps for addressing some of these concerns?
The major question now is whether or not Jebeli himself has the prerogative to actually form such a government. Ennahda obviously says that he doesn't, and they denounce that he did not consult with them before making such a public decision. And also there are other constitutional experts that say that in order for him to make such a move, he needs the support of the president, who is Moncef Marzouki, and he would also have to resign from the Ennahda party and possibly even form his own party with sympathizers within his own party of Ennahda.
So questions still on how this will play out. Bernard Yaros, quickly, have there been any suspects identified in Balid's killing or arrests so far?
There have been no arrests so far, and all we hear is that an investigation is still ongoing.
Bernard Yaros is editor with the news site Tunisia Live. He joined us from Tunis for the latest developments today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
This week, a handful of Democrats and Republicans in the House of Representatives introduced the first gun control bill since the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. The bill aims to crack down on gun trafficking and make it a felony to purchase a gun for someone else. But gun violence survivors and gun control advocates are calling for more action and say they'll push Congress to ban some types of guns and ammunition and run background checks on every gun purchase in the country. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Skirting the more controversial issues, the first bipartisan gun control bill of the 113th Congress would make firearms trafficking a federal crime with a penalty of up to 20 years in prison. One of the bill's co-sponsors, Maryland Democrat Elijah Cummings, said he'd rather see this narrow measure pass than attach it to a comprehensive bill that fails to win votes.
It is strictly aimed at straw purchasers and criminals and those who are forbidden by law already to purchase guns. I've intentionally steered away from the bigger proposals like assault weapons and background checks because while they are things that are near and dear to me, I want to make sure that I separate them from something where Republicans are coming on board. We just got another three today.
Yet at a press conference on Capitol Hill Wednesday, gun safety advocates criticized lawmakers for not taking up stronger control measures. Dr. Michael Nance, a trauma surgeon in Philadelphia, said gun violence should be treated as a public health crisis.
As a physician, I'm expected to practice medicine based on the best data available. Data is no less important when trying to combat a problem as complex as firearm injury. Yet in 1996, Congress enacted legislation which limited the Centers for Disease Control from funding firearms-related research. That simple language effectively shut off funds for all federal studies of gun violence.
That amendment, which cut the budget of the Center for Disease Control and banned them from, quote, advocating or promoting gun control, remains on the books today. And many current lawmakers have expressed opposition to any form of gun control. At a Senate hearing last week, several Republicans on the Judiciary Committee said Congress shouldn't enact any new laws to address gun violence until there's better enforcement of existing laws. But David Shipman, a former agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, told reporters Wednesday that the laws currently on the books are inadequate.
In Virginia, a high school senior, 18, can go into a gun show, can go on the internet, or can go into a McDonald's parking lot and buy a handgun, and it's perfectly legal. Why haven't we done something to stop this? The simplest thing is require any gun transaction in America to have a background check.
Over in the House, Representative Cummings told FSRN that no matter what happens with his gun trafficking bill, he'll continue to push for stricter gun control measures.
I had a nephew to be killed a year and a half ago. When he was murdered during a robbery in Norfolk, Virginia. He was a 20-year-old Old Dominion junior. He's dead. And my treasurer of my campaign just lost his son to gun violence within the last 10 days. I think his son was like about 21, 22. So I see it, and I live in the inner city of Baltimore, so I see it all the time, the results of gun violence. So it makes me want to work harder. because I know that there are lives that depend on what I do.
As the bill advances in the Republican-controlled House, gun safety advocates will be tracking the effectiveness of a similar measure passed Tuesday in Chicago's Cook County, which will go into effect this summer. Alice Holstein, FSRN, Washington.
Nagaland is home to one of India's oldest ethnic conflicts. Naga separatists in the country's northeast have been fighting for independence since 1947. The conflict has caused continued economic, social, and political instability in the region. Many civilians avoid public dialogue, but now the internet and social media are giving young Nagas a platform to discuss and debate politics openly. With assembly elections scheduled later this month, the online community is raising some key issues. FSRN's Gayatri Parameswaran and Felix Gayetka report from Nagaland.
Nagaland, a state with a population of about 2 million, is currently administered by India. 65 years ago, the Naga National Council, today known as the Federal Government of Nagaland, began a movement for self-determination. Luvitsu, who goes by one name, is the speaker of FGN.
Even before India became a nation, Nagas, fearing that our leaders, when even up to the to Delhi, to meet Mahatma Gandhi, that and told them that you should not be confused. Nagas are separate, and Nagas will remain separate. We will not join you. When that was told to Mahatma Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi said, we have every right to be independent.
After that meeting, the Naga National Council declared an independent Nagaland in 1947. The Naga National Council claims to have conducted a plebiscite in 1951, but the Indian government rejected its claims. A deadlock continued and India deployed its army in Nagaland. In 1956, the Naga National Council's armed wing began fighting the Indian army.
We are still living in fear of Indian army's notorious activities. We cannot move freely. And we cannot speak our rights, because whenever we speak our rights, we'll get beaten.
Over the years, rebel groups have taken up arms to fight for independence. Between 2004 and 2007, over 300 people died in armed conflict in Nagaland, according to an advocacy group called Geneva Declaration. But many in Nagaland have distanced themselves from the struggle, and some young people express disillusionment with the independent fighters. Robert Solo is a church youth leader.
People have been silent for so many years, but now everywhere the need is very much felt now to speak the truth and then to go for what is right. And also people are fed up of violence. And then everywhere there is a big question on the leadership. We don't trust our leaders anymore.
The silence that has long prevailed is now being replaced by an active online discussion. Various groups on Facebook, such as the Naga Blog, Naga Spear, She Naga, and Nagaland Times, are providing a platform like never before for the youth to raise their voices and engage with each other. Peter Rutsa is an administrator at the Naga Blog or TNB group on Facebook.
Here on the internet, we can have a discussion on any topic by sitting in our living rooms, in our kitchen. So it's accessible to lots of people, ordinary people, who cannot afford to come to Kohima or Dimapur to write an article that they want to share with the general population. And the nice thing about it is, about not just the TNB, but Facebook is, lots of people can log in from their mobiles, cheap mobiles.
The growth in online engagement is happening as Nagaland gears up for assembly elections. Many political entities, including the federal government of Nagaland, have opposed the polls. Luvitsu says the election will only bring another puppet government in place.
We are going to tell our people not to Indian election is not ours. We have nothing to do with the Indian elections.
The elections have also led to a heated discussion on Facebook. Robert Solo started a new online campaign called the Clean Election. The campaign also involves offline activity. Solo and other members have been meeting party leaders and urging them to regulate their election spending.
Now, you see, in these 2 years, the central government has sanctioned 5,600 crores to Nagaland state for development, but nothing has happened. Now we desire for the things to happen here. That is one of the reasons why we have been approaching most of the candidates.
On the Naga block, there's a poll running. Who do you think will win the 2013 elections? Comments on the poll reflect the lack of trust the Nagas have in the system. One person wrote, "The voters are unfortunate because they are left with no choice but to choose between the two evils." Voting will take place on February 23rd. With Felix Gatka, this is Gayatri Parameshwaran, Nagaland FSRN.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You are listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that's our program for today, Friday, February 8th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and again on Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by myself from the entire news team at CITR. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded with your host Matt right here on CITR 101.9 FM.